listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
So I wasn't invited to speak, but then a week ago or so, Ibrahim needed an MC, and so I was like, oh, okay, you know, maybe I'll do it. I wasn't invited to speak, but you know, maybe I'll speak as an MC. And then a couple of days ago, the other person, Kashif, who you would have had, he's a very funny guy. He would have done actually the morning one, and so because someone passed away in his family, he was unavailable. So now this is great. I get the whole day to speak. So it'll be great for me. And so where I'm coming from, I've been part of Muslimish for many, many years. I joined, I think, the year after it started. So I was in 2013. And I remember actually meeting Ibrahim, who you'll see speak in a second, my second meeting. And I was warned in my first meeting, the people had sort of warned me about Ibrahim. You'll see him. They wouldn't say what. Like, what was it I should be worried about? And so you'll be seeing Ibrahim in a second, but I think you'll be seeing different people today, different characters. And one of the goals of the conference is really to spread our message, also to bring in new people who may not necessarily be part of Muslimish as a core member, but interested in it. So spread the message more broadly, and also to people who might be interested. So we'll be seeing sort of a broad array of people, and hopefully you'll get a sense of what Muslimish is and what the different people are. And I think that's about it. So Ibrahim will start. It'll be 30 minutes per speaker. And right now, Ibrahim will be talking about practical activism. I don't know how much I should read the bios, but I'll just read it and we'll see how people feel. Ibrahim, and I spelled his name wrong on the thing. That's my fault. Ibrahim is an Egyptian-American atheist who grew up as a Muslim in Alexandria, Egypt. He moved to the United States in 2002 and was forced by overwhelming scientific information to admit the faulty nature of Islam, and not just Islam, all religions. In 2011, he met another former Muslim for the first time. This experience inspired him to meet other like-minded people. And so I'll note that that's the point of the conference, is to meet sort of like-minded people and to hear from like-minded people. And so he organized the first Muslimish meeting in New York City in May 30th, 2012. Ibrahim takes pride in being a founding member of Muslimish, who shaped the core principles and goals of the group. And so if you're unfamiliar with Muslimish, what I'll say now really reflects the group's message, which is creating a safe environment for discussion, fostering a pluralistic society, and abolishing blasphemy laws across the globe. Give it up for Ibrahim.
Hello. Thank you so much for coming today to the Muslimish conference. I don't know how many conferences we've had so far, but I've lost count. We've had at least one conference every year since 2013. Last year, we've had three conferences. This year, we're having three conferences in Boston, New York, and Detroit. And I'm going to be talking to you today about practical activism, because the reason I chose that topic is because I feel that there's a lot of groups that meet and like without a specific goal, without trying to just to achieve something. And we want to really get something done. And we want your help in doing that, because we're not going to be able to do it by ourselves. So let me just open the slideshow. Where's that? Oh, here we go. Thank you. Japanese at all.
Do you want to keep speaking? I'll just sit down.
Awesome. Thank you. Awesome. Thank you. So, like I was saying, I want to talk to you about practical activism. How do we achieve something? How do we get something done? Or at least try to do that. I want to start by thanking New York organizers, Zarar and Nabila, and also Iman, actually, from Boston, for coming here today. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank Hunter College for, you know, helping us get that space that to be able to speak and to record our talks, post it on social media so more people will be able to see them. So I want to start by, what is Muslimish? What is the group about? Muslimish is a group for people who are Muslim, who question the Quran and Hadith. They consider them, people who consider them, they still identify as Muslim in one way or another, but they have questions or they have things that don't sit well with them that are in the actual Quran or Hadith, which is a crime in many countries that we grew up in. But here in the United States, we're able to discuss these thoughts and ideas freely, and we're taking advantage of that. It's also can be Mish Muslim, which means not Muslim anymore, which I consider myself not Muslim anymore, except in certain conditions, if I'm going to be, you know, if there's some racist person, for example, who have like anti-Muslim bigotry, then I'm Muslim, because that's one of the times that I can, you know, I would find myself not defending Islam per se, because I don't, you know, like to defend religions. I don't like to defend ideologies that I don't agree with. But I feel that there is a lot of anti-Muslim bigotry in this country, and that the Muslim community does face a lot of, you know, challenges that I would stand with them in case, like, you know, I like to use the example of, like, if Trump was putting Muslims in concentration camp, then I'm Muslim. You know, you got to take me with them, because I really, you know, do belong with that group. Maybe not ideologically, but they are my people. So that's the two groups that form Muslimish. Who we are. We are a group of ex-Muslims and Muslims of various degrees of religiosity. People identify as Muslim in many ways that the majority of Muslims in the world would not agree with. Like, they would call them atheists, or they would call them, you know, different names. But they, as long as they consider themselves Muslim, even though if they don't agree with the Quran or Hadith, they are part of Muslimish. We come from diverse backgrounds, from atheist to agnostic to theist, ex-Muslims to cultural Muslim to believing Muslim, and more. Every meeting, we meet new people, and I'm sometimes surprised by how they see things or how they define things. But the shared character in the group is that people question special aspects in the Quran Hadith. We criticize the ideas without criticizing the people that hold them. For no idea should be so sacred to be beyond human curiosity and discussion. We, I think, we provide one of the few places, if not the only place, where you can actually discuss the tenets of Islam and specific verses of the Quran and specific hadiths among Muslims freely, and be able to share these ideas that are prohibited to be talked about. You cannot have these discussions in mosques. You could not have these discussions with your family. And for many people, it's a euphoric experience for them to meet someone else who comes from that shared background and shares these ideas or shares these criticisms that are held so sacred that you're not allowed to criticize. We can question religious beliefs without adopting discriminatory attitude towards our communities. We encourage skeptical thinking, but deplore all forms of bigotry, including racism, sexism, classism, anti-Semitism, and ageism. We think that no state should impose religious or irreligious beliefs. All citizens are entitled to exercise their free speech and live without fear of persecution or censorship. There are 13 countries in the world that punish criticism of Islam by death. And almost every single Muslim country has some sort of law that punishes criticism of religion, specifically Islam. This is something that I think is unique to the Islamic faith. I think not because, you know, well, really the Christian faith has gone past that through hundreds of years of Reformation and kings wanting to get divorces and such things. But we, because of many reasons, we are still stuck with this Islam in its almost original form. Quran has not been edited like the Bible, which has been translated and retranslated hundreds of times, and now people don't even pay attention to it anymore. The churches now are very at least some churches are accepting of gay people, and that is something that is very hard to see in the Muslim community. So I think even though we are lagging behind some other religious groups, I think because of the internet revolution and communication and the ease of communicating scientific information, I think we can leap through all these years of progress that the Christian culture has, you know, have been through. We have clear goals, and I like to talk about goals because I don't want to like just talk in the abstract. This is what we want to achieve. This is what we're going to do. We want to create a space for discussion, which we already do. We already do that. We have spaces for discussions in six cities in the U.S. and one in Canada. We have meetings in New York every 2 weeks, in other cities once a month. So we already create that space for if someone needs a space to discuss ideas, to speak, to say things that they can't say in their Muslim community, there is a space for them to do that. That's already being done. We want to foster a plural society. We want to foster a society where both people who identify as Muslim in one way or another and people who are ex-Muslim or don't believe in Islam anymore, have completely rejected religion, can work together to achieve common goals. So we can achieve the third goal, which is the most difficult one, which we really have not done anything yet to achieve, which is abolish blasphemy laws. I was talking to Wissam last night about trying to have some sort of roadmap towards achieving that goal, because that goal is daunting. And for many years within the group, we've had people who were actually against that goal because they feel it's too political, or they feel that it's going to take us into a more dangerous zone. But we are determined on achieving that goal. That's why really when the group started, that was the main goal, is to abolish blasphemy laws. Because I felt as an Egyptian moving to New York that I have a unique freedom. I think most Americans don't realize how precious freedom of speech in America is. But if someone who like grew up in Middle Earth, you move to America and you like realize, oh my God, I have this new toy, and it's an awesome toy. It's freedom of speech. I can say what I want here. And I'm not going to go to jail for it. No one is going to try to like kill me for it. And when you, if you grow up without that, and then you have it, you realize how precious it is. And I think most of the members of the group are first or second generation immigrants. And I think most of us recognize how precious the freedom of speech we have in America is. Activities, what do? We have speakers' corners in six cities. I say speakers' corners because that was like, as growing up as a child, I used to read about speakers' corner in Hyde Park in London. And that was for me like a magical place, a place where people can go and they can say their opinion and people discuss different things. And when I went to London in 2014, I found that speakers' corner in Hyde Park has been hijacked by terrorists, Muslim terrorists, who really, you can't say your opinion. I was attacked physically there. And it reminded me how lucky we are in America that we don't have these terrorist groups, really. that have taken over a lot of European capitals. So we are creating these groups, and we can meet freely without, like, the, and there are groups in Europe. There's like the, we are actually the first group when I was first started. There was nothing in North America, and I contacted CFI, and I contacted a group in London that was started by Mariam Namazi called the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain, and she helped me and other groups start. But now we have six cities where we have meetings regularly, and if someone wants to meet, they can find us. They can find us on Meetup, and they can come to the meetings and have a discussion about things that don't sit well with them. Something that I didn't have when I was questioning Islam, because before I didn't just wake up one day and just like say this is wrong. I spent 4 years thinking about this, and it was a very difficult time for me because there was nobody to talk to. And I feel that this is a great place. I hope it is. And that's my goal, is to have a place where people who have things that don't sit well with them, they can come and they can discuss these things with others. We're also building communities. We're connecting people. We are building lifetime friendships that people are, you know, I see it over the years. We started in 2012, and we have a lot of people now who are friends for life, who have met each other, who like didn't, you know, were rejected by their families in some point, and some of them had really difficult circumstances that they grew up in, and, you know, family abuse and other things. And having this community and having friends and people to trust and people to be able to talk to, I think is valuable, and I think it's life-saving. We're also building alliances with other secular groups. It's very important for us to be, you know, collaborative and work with other groups because we have common goals. I think it's important that we keep our meetings or our meetups for people from Muslim background only. I feel the reason for that is because people from Muslim background, when we sit together, you want to be able to criticize things that you grew up in without feeling that, you know, there are outside criticism. You're among your own people and you can discuss these things freely. It's a very difficult thing to criticize things that are sacred to your family and that are, you just grew up taught that you cannot say this is wrong. So you have to do it among people who come from the same background. I think that's important. But at the same time, we need to make alliances with other groups so we can try to achieve goals, try to get something done, not just sit together and feel good about ourselves. I mean, that's good. That's valuable. But we want to achieve something. We're going to want to get something done. We don't want to just be like another group that's touchy-feely and everybody feels good about themselves. We want to get something done. We want to change the world. So in order to do that, we have to work with other groups. We have to create alliances to get that done. We're creating online content. We're sharing that content on YouTube, on podcasts, on Facebook, on Instagram, on different platforms, so we can reach more people. People who can't be there in person, people who are in Muslim countries who are told often that they're the only one. Like, you think you're the only one? You think you're right and all wrong? Yeah, I'm right and you're all wrong. So, you know, to tell them that there are other people out there who think the same thing, who think that there's something wrong with a man getting double the inheritance of a woman, or of a man having the, you know, a man's testimony in court being worth double a woman's testimony, or with, you know, a man being allowed to beat his wife, or with a man who's supposedly the most honorable man in history marrying a 9-year-old girl, and speak about that and discuss it and discuss things that don't sit well with us and be able to have these conversations, because these issues have real life consequences. This is not just some theoretical discussion. There are people who are suffering because of these beliefs and they have negative impact on people. So we need to be able to talk about the problems in order to fix them. It's not just like, Anyway, I think you get my point. Practical alliance. Muslims who want to reform Islam are treated as atheists. There are a lot of people in Muslim countries that if they criticize Islam in any way, they are put in jail or even though they consider themselves Muslim, even though, like I'll give you an example of a guy called Islam al-Bahiri in Egypt, who was put in jail for 3 years because he didn't criticize the Quran. He claims he's Muslim. He says everything, but he says, just said there are some things in the hadith that are crazy, which there are. And he was put in jail for 3 years for that. Not even saying he's an atheist. Just, and there are many other writers who've been Hamad Bouzid. He was divorced. They forced him to be like, they separated him from his wife. He didn't divorce his wife. The court separated from his wife because no Muslim woman should be married to a non-Muslim man. So the court separated him from his wife because they thought that his views that were not criticizing the Quran, not even criticizing the Quran, criticizing the Sunnah, were un-Islamic or atheist in nature. And there were other writers that were assassinated and still getting us in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Turkey, in many countries. Now, that's not even counting a country like Saudi Arabia that, like, you know, that puts people in jail for tweeting. And what's the name of the blogger? Raif Badawi. He's in jail for how many years now? He gets lashed on Fridays in front of the mosque for tweeting about... And most of these people claim to be Muslim or say that they're Muslim. So they are treated as atheists. They're de facto atheists, even though that they say they're Muslims. And there are non-Muslims, mish-Muslims, who are discriminated against as Muslims. Like, when I go through airport security, I'm not treated as an atheist. I'm treated as a Muslim. I'm still treated as Muslim here. My name is Ibrahim Abdullah. I'm treated as Muslim everywhere I go. And so we have a practical alliance here to be done. People who are Muslim but have certain views that don't fall within the rigid framework of traditional Islam, and people who are ex-Muslims, who are still being discriminated against as Muslims, we have a practical alliance that needs to be made. We have practical issues we're dealing with. Freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is something that in Muslim countries, you cannot say your opinion freely about Islam. You cannot criticize Islam in any way. And even people, when they come here, and I see this a lot in Muslimish conferences, because this, for me, in my mind, is a chance to talk about the issues directly. I feel sometimes that, like, I'm one of the very few people who actually talks about the issues directly. And everybody else is just trying to, like, say it nicely or talk around it, which is, it's a nice approach. But I feel that we need to address the issues head on in order to be able to fix them. Equality is a huge issue in the Muslim community. We have laws in most countries that give women half a man's inheritance. And for hundreds of years, we've had that. I mean, think about the impact that has on women in Muslim communities. And really, one of the reasons that made me start being an activist is that when I told my friends that I was going to give my daughter same inheritance as my son, I was attacked by my friends in Egypt. And that's really what led me to start speaking about this, because the backlash that I faced for not even saying I'm an atheist, for just saying that men or women should get equal inheritance, was ridiculous. Anti-Muslim bigotry is real in America. I've seen it. I've witnessed it. I've experienced it. And just because I don't believe in Islam anymore doesn't mean that, you know, I don't face it. And so I think we need to be able to speak, and I think we have a lot of credibility as people who do not believe in Islam anymore to speak about that. And it's important for us to do that because this is our community, these are our people. We need to be able to provide the safety for them to be, like, because if you're under attack, hold on tighter to these beliefs, because if you feel that you're being attacked because of it, I know I, for one, when I moved here after 9/11, I felt I didn't used to pray in Egypt, and I started praying when I came to America, because I felt that, like, I'm gonna hold on tighter to these beliefs. It was really what happened was having a daughter and going to the Museum of Natural History every weekend. It just I couldn't defend that stuff anymore. It felt ridiculous after a while. Because once you have a true understanding of what evolution is, once you learn something, you can't unlearn it, really. We have an American advantage. We have an American advantage, and we need to use it. The European Court of Human Rights ruled in October 2018 that an Austrian woman's conviction for calling Muhammad a pedophile did not violate her freedom of speech. This is the European court. And I'm mentioning this because one of our last conferences last year in December in Detroit, we had a panel in the Muslimish conference that had six speakers sitting on it. And when Wissam asked the question about that issue, none of them thought that was that ruling was wrong. None of them thought that anything, and that was in the Muslimish conference. So I need to talk about this because I need to correct a wrong here. I need to correct a wrong because that ruling is a violation of freedom of speech. And we have a unique opportunity here in the United States to be able to speak about these things. We also have a lower risk of terrorist attacks. I've witnessed this myself when I went to London and I saw how Islamist groups are so strong there that that you can't say your opinion freely, even in Speaker's Corner, in Speaker's goddamn corner, a place that is just created for having that. You cannot. I was attacked physically there. So I didn't leave. I stayed. The person who attacked me ran away. But the point is, there is a lot of consequences to having these discussions. In Europe, we have a much better chances here in the United States. Also, and I was talking again to Osama about this yesterday, U.S. influences the policy of many Muslim countries. That's just a fact of life. You know, we had Mubarak for 30 years, and then the U.S. told him to leave, and he left. So we can influence policies in Muslim countries from here. And I'm not talking about the UN. I think the UN is a useless organization. I'm talking about the United States government. And I think we need to start lobbying, which we haven't done, but we need to start doing. Yes. But we need to start lobbying to have the United States government influence the policy of other Muslim countries, which they already do. We just want them to do it for towards secular values, towards separation of church and state, towards freedom of speech, something that is a core tenet of what America is about, at least in my mind. American challenges. It's not all rosy. So American foreign policy typically supports moderate Islamists. For years, since Afghanistan in 1979, for some reason, the United States policy has been to support these people that are Islamists, starting bin Laden. Bin Laden was getting a paycheck from the CIA. Because they think that is, you know, it started as combating communism, but now they think it's, they still support the Muslim Brotherhood in some ways. I think the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization. And all militant Muslim groups have some connection to the Brotherhood and have some roots in the Brotherhood. There's a lot of positive views about religion and religious ideology in America. I mean, Europe is, for all its faults, it's still a lot more secular than America. There's a lot of respect for religion here. I don't understand that. You have to put your hand on a book full of lies and swear to tell the truth. There's also what I call liberals' low expectations. They're like we need these freedoms for us, but for these people over there, they don't need it right now. They're just brown people. They can't have that now, or like that's not important for them. And there's also something we face here in Muslim, which is unwanted Christian interest. I get a lot of like Christian groups that think that this is a group that changes Muslims to Christians. And I'm like, no, this is not what we do here. This is a group for people who want to discuss things that are wrong, not to just go to another thing that's also wrong. I would say even more wrong. But to actually like be able to come up with solutions and come up with different alternatives that are really secular and create a better world, hopefully. Work in progress. We have meetups and we want to have meetups in every major city in the U.S. We are in six cities now, but we will be. This is going to be done. It's going to be done. We're going to be in every major city in the U.S. because if you are in a big city and you want to speak about something, you need to be able to come and have this discussion, because this discussion cannot be had in mosques. It cannot be had in Muslim communities. You're going to face dire circumstances. Even if it's not like, you know, physical attacks, it's going to be, there's economic consequences. There's many, many things that could happen wrong. Social issues. We want to have a majority women board. And the reason I say that is because I feel that the issues with Islam affect women the most. And I don't like, and I thank you, Iman, for coming here, because I didn't want this conference to be all men speaking and without any women. It's be ridiculous. It's not Saudi Arabia. So we need to have a majority women board, and we're working towards that. We're getting closer to that goal now. But I feel that the board needs to be majority women because the ex-Muslim issues and the secular Muslim issues are women's issues in the first place. And I feel that we need to be able to enable people. Okay, thank you. I'm not going to take long on that. Enable women to talk about these issues themselves. I want to take a back seat. I want to retire, really. I want to be another person who just can just say their opinion freely. Because also, and there's a selfish reason here, is that I feel that people take my opinion highly, which I don't want that to happen. I just want to be another guy who can say their opinion freely. I don't want my opinion to have any more weight than anybody else. And in order to do that, I just have to take a back seat from leadership, and I want to do that. That's one of my personal goals. We want to create resources, referrals, and support. Resources for people. They need resources for work, for immigration issues, for housing, for therapy. We cannot be a group that has all these issues. We need to be able to refer to other groups and other organizations that can help our members. And that is part of our alliances and building these resources pool and building these connections. We need to do that. We want a staff member. We really need to do that because we have to do screenings for new members. We have to actually talk to every new person who joins the group. So we need someone to help with that. We need someone to help with many, many things. So that's one of our goals. We need to create more educational and scientific content, especially in English and Arabic and French and Urdu and in many languages. We need to create that content and put it online for people to be able to access it. We want to create a road. I added this yesterday or something. We need to create a roadmap to abolish blasphemy laws. And hopefully we will have a conference next year with other groups in order to come up with that roadmap. How are we going to get this done? It's a goal for us. We really don't know how we're going to get it done yet. We've worked on two other goals. I told you we have three goals: create a space for discussion, pluralist society, and abolish blasphemy laws. We are doing the first two. The third, we are nowhere close to that. But we need to start working on it. We need to start doing something about that because, in my mind, it's the most important goal. It's the most difficult goal, but it's the most important goal. And lobbying. I call it lobbying, not advocacy, because I'm not ashamed to say that word. I think we just need to call a spade a spade. We need to start lobbying to get that done. How can you help? I need something from you. I'm not just, I want actionable things. I want you to tell your Muslimish friends. If you know someone who is Muslimish, who questions the Quran, who questions the Sunnah. And I'm not saying your Muslim friend who drinks, because there are a lot of Muslims who drink, but they really, they think they're doing something wrong. They're like, oh man, sorry. No, I'm actually talking about someone who questions the tenets of Islam, who thinks that there's something wrong with a man having double woman's inheritance, that the rule itself is wrong, that banning adoption is wrong, that a 50-year-old man marrying a 9-year-old girl should not be called the most honorable man on earth. Questions these things directly. I want you to share our online content to reach more people. I want you to connect us with other secular groups and organizations that have similar goals. And share actionable ideas. We don't have all the answers. The whole point of the group is to create a space where people can share their ideas so we can come up with the best ideas that work for us and take action, do something, not just speak about it. Thank you for coming. Please visit our website. And thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Do you want to stay up here? Does anyone have questions?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that even in the most conservative society, Saudi, they had change this year. They allowed women to drive. How did that happen? I think it's interesting to study why that change could happen.
Well, what I'm going to say about that is that they did allow women to drive, but they put all the activists who were calling for women to drive in jail. So all the activists who have been fighting for years for women to drive, they were put to jail, but they allowed women to drive. I cannot explain that except like I can, you know, I can say that they're trying to appear as if they're modernizing. Because, you know, and because, well, again, this is completely speculation, and I really sometimes try to avoid going on political issues because it doesn't help us to create more problems than the ones that we already have. But I'm going to say that I feel that it's because that move to put the crown prince in charge, they needed to give like the West some like, you know, a carrot. And I think that's the reason. But that's my speculation, that I don't know if that's right or wrong. I mean, there's one thing that I know is like I don't think my opinion is always right. I think there's only one thing I'm right about, that this religion is wrong. I'm absolutely clear about that. It's absolutely wrong. There's no question about that. But everything else, maybe. I don't know.
Thanks. We can save more questions for the panel discussion. So we'll have a panel discussion for 1 hour after the next two speakers. Yeah, that was a great talk. Also very pretty slides. We had been talking about making pretty slides before, and so it was nice to see that. So the next speaker is Iman Akam, and she was born in Saudi Arabia to Sudanese parents who then immigrated to the United States in 1998. She completed a PhD in chemistry from the University of Arizona and is currently a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard Medical School and the Mass Gen Hospital. Iman is an educator, a mentor, an activist, and a Muslimish member. She holds a passion for science, mentorship, outreach, and the advancement and representation of historically marginalized communities in scientific fields. And as was mentioned earlier, she's also the organizer in Boston. And today she'll be speaking about gender hierarchies in Islam. So that'll be an interesting topic given Ibrahim's mention about the issues of gender in terms of Muslimish, in terms of Islam. So give it up.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And thank you to the New York organizers for putting this together. I'm really looking forward to all the talks that are going to happen today. I think there's a really good lineup. So, as Zarar mentioned, I'm going to talk to you about gender hierarchies in Islam. But I do want to preface the talk with a few things. So, it's a very delicate conversation. So, I just want to say a few things just to frame this talk and kind of let you know the reason why I'm talking about this issue. So starting with this quote by Majid Nawaz, where he says that in an open society, no idea should be above scrutiny, just as no people should be beneath dignity. And this is something that Ibrahim touched on, so I won't dwell on it. But I think that in order for us to progress, we have to really be able to criticize ideas. And we can do that without dehumanizing people. So these conversations, when we try to have these conversations, these very difficult conversations in the West, what happens is that the conversation gets hijacked and then really ground to dust between the modern pestle that is social liberals and Western social conservatives, because conservatives take our narrative and push anti-Muslim bigotry, push their own narrative, and liberals mistake us for anti-Muslim bigots. So I think we really need to clarify that what we're doing here is we're talking about ideas. We're not criticizing people, and the reason that we want to do this is because, of course, we as people who, so for example, for me and other members of Muslimish, we have deeply invested in the well-being of Muslim women. We have Muslim brothers, Muslim sisters, Muslim mothers, Muslim friends and daughters, and some of us are Muslims ourselves. So there's no one who cares more about the well-being of Muslim women than we do. So we really need to have this conversation in order for us to face our problems. And the first step in solving our problems is facing our problems. So as Zarar mentioned, I am a scientist, but I'm not a, I don't produce any social science work. I'm a chemist, so I don't produce any of the work that I'm going to be talking about today. But I just have an interest in gender equality and equity. And so one thing that I was interested in, and one thing I've been keeping track of over the years is global gender gaps. So one of the most, most respected reports is this Global Gender Gap Report by World Economic Forum, and this is the latest one from 2018. And this report is very comprehensive. It looks at 149 countries. It varies slightly from year to year. But what they do is they measure gender disparity based on four parameters, which is our economic participation, educational attainment, political empowerment, and health and survival of men versus women. So, of course, I frame everything from a scientific perspective because that's how I look at things. So, in this report, countries are given a number, a scale from 0 to 1, with 1 being parity. And so, this is the summary of the report where the countries are listed here, where based on the gender gap. And at the top is the smallest gender gap, here in this case, Iceland, and at the bottom, the largest gender gap, which is Yemen in this case. So what I've done over the years, this is the same report again, I'm just blowing it up so you can see it better. Now the largest gender gap is over here, and the smallest is over here. And then this thick line over here is for the global population-weighted average. So I'm going to point out all the countries that are Muslim countries, Muslim majority countries, and I'm breaking them down by the involvement of religion in government. So there are only a couple of countries that don't have that are Muslim majority but don't have a specific declaration about Islam. Then I'm in blue. I'm showing the secular Muslim majority countries. So there's separation between government and religion, and then here I'm showing the countries where Islam is a state religion. And then finally, there are 5 countries which are actual Islamic states, so they follow Sharia law. And these are 5 of 6 countries that are in existence. So in case you missed it, the countries where that are Islamic states are all fall right here. So when I look at data like this, it's definitely, I see a pattern where there's clustering of the Muslim majority countries towards the larger gender gaps. And because these are countries from different continents, they have different languages spoken there, the thing that's really uniting them is the religion. So if we look at the stats from this report, they're just very disturbing. So 84% of the Muslim majority countries in this report fall below the global average. 60% of the Muslim majority countries in the survey fall in the bottom 17% of ranks. The 5 countries with the highest gender gap are all Muslim majority countries, and 14 of the 15 countries with the highest gender gaps are all Muslim majority countries. So this is clearly indicative of a huge problem. And I think we really need to look at what in Islam, because I think Islam is uniting, or is not uniting. Islam is the common thing amongst all these countries. So what is it about Islam that leads to this? So a few things we can agree on is that the Quran is the word of God, and Muslims follow the Quran. I don't think there's any dispute in that, but there is some survey data that confirms this. So, and we also know that for the majority of Muslims across many different countries, Islam is very important to them. So this survey just shows the percent of individuals that say religion is very important in their lives. Okay, so given all of this, there are Quranic verses that are problematic in terms of establishing women as second-class citizen. There are a few of them, but I think today I'm only going to talk about 2. One which talks about testimony, the value of testimony of women versus men, and then one talks about the hierarchy of women within a marriage. So this first verse, which is in chapter 2, it's verse 282. It's a pretty lengthy one. So this is the Arabic version over here, and then this is the English version translated with the Sahih International translation, which is, I think, the most widely accepted translation. And I'm just highlighting the text that I find problematic, or the key text. So it says that, and bring to witness two witnesses from among your men. And if there are not two men available, then a man and two women from whom you accept as witness. So that if one of the women errs, the other can remind her. And there have been, so I think it's clearly a problem, because it shows you or tells you that one woman's testimony is not the equivalent of one man's. You need two women. And there's a hadith that goes along with this that's much more disturbing, and it's been used, it's cited a lot to explain, to show that women are less intelligent or less valuable than men. The second verse is from chapter 4, verse 34. And I think this one is probably the most problematic in the Quran, and it's usually referred to as the wife-beating verse. It goes, men are in charge of women by right of what Allah has given one over the other and what they spend for maintenance from their wealth. So righteous women are devoutly obedient, guarding in the husband's absence what Allah would have them guard. But those wives from whom you fear arrogance, first advise them, then if they persist, forsake them in bed, and finally strike them. But if they obey you once more, seek no means against them. Indeed, Allah is ever exultant and grand. And so I think this verse, it's so problematic. And if you go to the literature, you'll see a lot of scholars and a lot of imams trying to justify this, or justify or explain or soften the blow of this verse. So some of the common things that are said about this verse is that the corporal punishment should be light. It should be done with a small object, no larger than a toothbrush. I think this is one that a lot of people say. And somebody even recently said, or this was a woman, that she said that it wouldn't even be considered domestic abuse in the U.S. Another thing that people say often is that the Prophet was uneasy about this verse and he didn't implement it with his own wives. And there's a lot of scholars that I think mostly this explanation is given by scholars that the Arabic is not their native language. They dispute the meaning of ضربهن, which is the word that means to strike. But I think for most Arabic speakers, the meaning of this is very clear. But anyway, regardless of how this verse is explained away, I think it's very clear that it establishes a hierarchy. It puts men in charge of women, and I think that's obviously very problematic. And what I find even most disturbing is that a lot of women, especially who say that they are Muslim, don't even know the extent, like the wording of this verse exactly. So I think one of the reasons why I want to talk about this. So I think there are a few things that we need to do in order for us to first face this problem, and then we can address it. We really can't delude ourselves into thinking that these verses are not interpreted in the way and exactly the way that make women second-class citizens, because the reality is they really, really are. If we look at surveys for instance, this is a survey from the Pew Research Center. It asks, I don't remember how many people, but it's in thousands, tens of thousands of people across different countries about Islam and how Islam is interpreted. And the majority of people agree that there's only one way to interpret Islam. So this manifests itself in many ways. The interpretation of those verses that are that place women as second class citizens. For example, I showed you the global gender gaps, but there are also other studies where this is very evident. So one study, which is by Alexander and coworkers, they looked at 130,000 individuals from 83 different societies, and they surveyed them on whether how much they agree with statements like this. So, for example, university education is more important for a boy than a girl. And based on their answer, they established this patriarchy score. So the higher the score, the higher that patriarchal values are held. And so in this graph here, on the x-axis is the patriarchal values score. And then here it is broken down by religion. And these highest three are all views of Muslims. So Muslims hold higher patriarchal values than do other religions. And in a similar way, this is another Pew survey. So they grouped two questions together, but one of the questions was, a wife must obey her husband, and they looked at how Muslims across the world agree or disagree with this. And the majority of Muslims that are not in Europe agree. So more than 70% of Muslims agree that a woman should obey her husband, or a wife should obey her husband. Another thing that I want to point out is that this is not just prejudices, I guess, manifest themselves not just on a societal level, but also on an individual level. So in this study again by Alexander and coworkers, they're now showing that the patriarchy score for Muslims based on Muslims and non-Muslims based on if they're in a non-Muslim or Muslim majority society. So this is here you can see that for, I don't know if you can see actually, but this is Muslims in a Muslim society, and this is non-Muslims in a Muslim society. So Muslims in Muslim society have higher patriarchal score versus non-Muslims in the same Muslim societies. So this kind of shows you that Muslims in general have a higher, have stronger patriarchal tendencies. But if you look at Muslims in non-Muslim societies, they also hold higher patriarchal values than non-Muslims in non-Muslim societies. So this manifests itself both at an individual and a societal level. So this is comparing Muslims in a Muslim society and Muslims in a non-Muslim society. The score is always higher. And the same is true if we compare Muslims versus non-Muslims. So another study that I want to show you is this one, in which about 20,000 people from 15 different countries were asked about whether or not they support gender equality. And so this is the data that was collected and is broken down by men versus women. And this is the 50% of the population line. And so you can see that for the majority of countries, less than half the population, regardless if it's women or men, don't believe that women should be equal to men. If this doesn't disturb you, then I think you're not seeing the implication of this data, because this is exactly what brainwashing looks like when women don't think they should be equal to men. Another thing that I want to say is that this is a similar kind of survey in which participants, Muslims, were asked, for example, this question is, when jobs are scarce, men should have more right to a job than women. And across Muslim countries, 77% of the population, on average, 77% of the population agree that men should have a priority for jobs. 75% of the population agree that men make better political leaders. And then 71% agree that a wife must always obey her husband. So I think these are all indicative that women are viewed as second-class citizens. So we really need to. I think it clearly shows that the verses are being interpreted in a way that makes women second-class citizens. So we really can't deny that. We also just can't compare the status of women in Muslim majority countries to those of Muslims in Muslim minority countries. Because data has shown that even though U.S. Muslims, for example, and Muslims worldwide believe in one God and one prophet, when we go to other aspects of religion, for example, if Quran should be read literally word for word, only 50% of U.S. Muslims agree with that statement, while in this case, there was only data from sub-Saharan Africa, 80% think that the Quran should be read word for word. And then if we also look at the interpretation of Islam globally, globally, Muslims, 63% of Muslims think that there's only one way to interpret Islam, while only 37% of U.S. Muslims think that. And there are other data that indicate that the view of Muslims in Muslim minority countries are very different from those in Muslim majority countries. So this is the survey that I showed you earlier. So when it comes to the question of whether when jobs are scarce, men should have more right to jobs than women, 77% worldwide, while only 10% of U.S. Muslims agree with that statement. And then university education being more important for boys versus girls, 75% of Muslims worldwide agree, but only 22% of Muslims in the U.S. agree with that. So the viewpoints of Muslims in the U.S. and worldwide are very different. So we can't really compare them. And then we can't really look at just only one aspect of gender equality. A lot of studies, especially in the West, look at only education. And so you see a lot of articles like this one that say that gender equality in schools in Muslim countries is better than those in the U.S., and some even claim that there's something for us to learn from Muslim majority countries in terms of girls in science and mathematics. But the reality is there's this phenomenon called the gender equality paradox in STEM. So STEM being science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, where there is a negative correlation between the number of women who graduate from STEM fields versus the gender gap. So the higher the gender gap, the more, so this is actually the opposite. More gender equality here leads to lower numbers of women graduating from STEM fields, while when there's a higher gender gap, there are more women that graduate from STEM field. So this has been explained, I'll just go back for a second. This has been explained to having to do with the freedom of choice. So women in gender equal countries are more likely to pursue careers just out of their interests and or passion rather than for financial freedom or security. So because this conversation is so difficult to have and because we tend to avoid this conversation, we really don't have a lot of studies that focus on the psychology of women, of Muslim women, and we really need to explore that. We really need more scientific studies that focus on the psychology of Muslim women. The studies that exist right now are quite disturbing, in my opinion, where women really see. So, for instance, in this study from Indonesia, I think women say that the husbands are the key to paradise. So this is why they obey them and kind of cater to them. And the other studies are equally as disturbing. So I think we really need more data on women, their perception, and I'm sure there's a lot that we're really not understanding because we don't have the data. So this is pretty much all I have to say. I think we can't really just ignore these issues. I think a lot of us, I shouldn't say us, but a lot of people, a lot of Muslim people, I mean, I think I was one of them, kind of just delude ourselves into thinking that these problems don't exist. We just kind of go into denial because it's very comfortable. But I think we really just can't do that. So that's my message, and that's all I have to say. So thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you, Aman. That was a really interesting talk. So we have time for maybe two or three questions. The one thing I was just going to mention, for being, I have a psych background, but I also know a lot of people in the medical field. And so the gender gap sort of exists just in academia and in medicine. And it's very interesting that it's true for women. The fact that's interesting, what you brought up here, is that it's true for women as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I just point, that's a very interesting thing that mm-hmm. It's due to cultural norms, as you're saying,
societal
and
problems.
And it's not like because men are, it's like a societal thing that needs mm-hmm. to change. And mm-hmm. but anyway, I was just pointing out that that's true here. even probably, I don't know if it's Hunter College, but it's definitely true in all the academic settings I've been in. I guess maybe you've had the same experience. Like, both men and women have these problems. And so do you have other questions?
It's not necessarily a question, but it's more a comment towards your point. Like, I loved your presentation. It was fantastic. And especially the part where you talked about how a woman is equivalent to half a man's testimony. So I actually went to an Islamic school right here in New York City, and the way that when I was learning this in my Quran class, my teacher, who was actually a Muslim female, the way she was explaining this verse, it was kind of what you were referring to, denialism, where she was actually telling us as young middle schoolers that this is a form, that there's been scientific studies that conduct the way the man's brain is different from a female's brain. And then when you're teaching this to a room full of middle schoolers, they accept this as truth. And then now looking older and reflecting back, I thought that was just as equally as disturbing.
Mm. And I mean, you can imagine, right? Like you probably don't even know that you just kind of really internalize these messages. And I mean, they manifest themselves, I think, in a lot of ways. And we're just now looking at subconscious bias in the U.S., not in the U.S., and I mean in Western world in general, and how that, you know, affects like racial bias and things like that. So that's subconscious bias. That's very implicit bias. So I can't even imagine the magnitude of something like that, which was very explicit bias, yeah.
Other questions?
How do you suggest that someone who's never been Muslim, like myself, approach these conversations? I tend to think of myself as a very progressive person, but for instance, I run Black Nonbelievers, and there was an incident in my group where I had a pretty heated debate with a woman, as a matter of fact, about the way women are treated in Islam. She was of the opinion that everything is fine, and I was of the complete opposite opinion. But and we got into this heated argument. I found people siding with her because I am a man and she's a woman, and I can't explain things to a woman because I'm not a woman.
Oh,
I'm not Muslim. But I felt, like, rightfully so, I think that I was more on the progressive side of the argument. But because of, I guess, what some people would term as more, what is the term? Gender? Not, what is the term I'm looking for? It's more about, you know, your status in life than about the argument that you're presenting in some way. So how do you think that someone like myself, who's not a woman, who's never been Muslim, how do I go about, you know, expressing my opinions or sort of pushing for a more progressive conversation?
I think that's very, very difficult. I find that there's nothing gets somebody more angry than somebody telling them the truth to their face when they don't want to hear it. My approach has always been to kind of come from like a, you know, I have data. This is the data. This is what the data shows. But I think it's very difficult when you, like, you know, being a Black woman also, I think if someone who has not had my experience tried to tell me something about my experience, I think it's just very delicate. So I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's very delicate. and especially the fact that we don't have these conversations. So we don't have these conversations. You're automatically going to be labeled a bigot. You're against religion. You don't like Islam, or you don't like... Because we get labeled that way, even though, you know, no one cares more than us. So I don't know. But I don't know if anybody else has a suggestion. I mean,
I think she's right. Numbers are your friend. Like, data, have your statement backed by the data, that this is what the numbers are, and these coming from the reputed surveys conducted in those societies. So whatever your subjective observation is, it doesn't really matter what the objective truth is backed by the data. That's the way to go about it.
I've got a comment on that. I'm sorry. I mean, I consider myself a rationalist person too, and my training's in science. But it's been shown that presenting people with data does not change their minds at all. In fact, it causes a backlash. So the way to change people's minds is to just make friends with them and then slowly, gingerly deal with the issue.
Yeah, or it's the case that it's like, usually it's supposed to be, in psychology, it's like emotions are thought to come first. Even if you think reason exists, reason actually operates slower than emotions do. So usually you want to cater to what are they feeling? What are they, and you know, so, and like addressing that, I'm not attacking you. Don't be threatened. So people get threatened, so you want to make sure they don't feel threatened. And yeah, so it's usually that, which is funny because it's not reason at all.
Right.
It's like you're just catering. But yeah, I think the friend example is maybe the easier one. You want them to make sure they feel like you're friendly and stuff. So
I think that like to be focusing also and not explaining their own experience, because I think when you go through, when you tell someone, oh, your experience must have been this, then there's going to be even more of a backlash, mm-hmm. rather than, oh, well, the laws in this country are not very, very good.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I think it goes back to the criticizing of ideas rather than the person. And I think I agree with Zarar in that you appeal to the emotional side rather than the reason initially.
And that's what a personal story ends up being. A personal story is emotional.
Hi, I'm very sorry. I came in really literally at the end, so I can't. This is really unfortunate. I'm so sorry that I missed the presentation. I can't speak to the presentation per se, but I guess if I can just sort of interject, you know, language matters. So, in your response to the gentleman, you said, you know, people, you know, maybe don't respond well, or they, you know, kind of respond adversely to truth. And then you said yourself, like, I would find it difficult when someone would tell me about my own experience. So I guess I just invite people to consider that people's experience is their truth. And so, you know, I'm thinking of, I think the word you were looking for, identity politics.
Exactly.
Maybe? But I love what this gentleman said, right? That cognitive dissonance is there. And so just presenting someone with numbers, they're going to turn off and they're going to go into that defensive mode, right? But then if you're, you know, sort of approaching it as a conversation where you have questions, you're not approaching it as, I'm here to superimpose the truth. You know, upon your experience. So I think it's more, you have questions and they're valid questions, and then maybe we bring in some of the numbers and the data, right? But then we're also just making it a conversation. Because I think, again, I'm so sorry, I missed it, whatever, it was probably an amazing presentation, but I just think that, of course, this exists while people's experience exists, and I think that because there's not enough data and not enough conversations, I think that's the work.
And that'll be the last question,
yeah,
and we'll move on.
Yeah, just to reinforce some comments.
First of all, I'm annoyed by Pew. They have become the go-to source about Islam. And I remember this going on like the last 15 years. And when you look at the way they frame their questions, not in the data that you presented, I had a lot of questions about that, mm-hmm. when they were in America in the last 15 years, the way they put questions to us, I think has to be questioned. And I agree that this data obsession does not help us. I don't know who it helps, frankly. It may help our adversaries. And I think maybe rather than accumulating this, maybe approach it completely differently. I myself am a social scientist, and I don't have the answer, but I think we've got to just put this aside. There is no end to this data, and there's millions of dollars, you know, allocated to it, and I don't know who the Muslims are who are in Pew, but I know there's some. Dalia Mujahid, I think, was very active there. Maybe she wasn't.
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Pardon?
Yes.
She was. But anyway, there ought to be many more. But still, somehow, we need a way of telling our stories and recreating our identity outside this kind of data. Mm. And we're all struggling with that. I think we need more personal stories, and I think we need to challenge Pew, who is considered sort of our friend. I'll just leave it at that.
But I think, if I can make a comment, we can't quantify personal stories. I think that's the problem.
Well, we can. We can't quantify, but we can qualify. And
yeah.
We have to work at that.
But then
even
when we...
as social scientists, there are ways of doing it. You know, there are. I work at that myself.
Okay, so we'll continue this with the panel discussion. It's an interesting thing of data versus personal stories and et cetera. And what's funny is that, there's something funny about that, the data would tell you which is better, but...
that's what it says, there's scientific evidence.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's better. But, I mean, yeah. I won't continue this, but we'll definitely continue in the panel discussion. I think it's a very interesting topic, and so sort of continuing like this idea of, I think we've had so far two very different perspectives in relation to Muslimish, in relation to Islam. Our next speaker, Ahmed Shalbiya, will be giving a talk now on root problems and issues with Islam. Critics, and he's often spoken before at Muslimish, and he often has a sort of a different perspective than, say, someone like Ibrahim, and that offers sort of the diversity that we might need in order to think through some of these issues and have a pluralistic society. And so Ahmed is a trained physician who practiced clinical pediatrics and neonatal intensive care for nearly 14 years in developing and developed country settings before being involved in public health and global health policy. Before joining Columbia's School of Public Health, he worked on health sector reform within the ministries of health in Egypt. He was instrumental in the development of the basic national health benefits package of health services, as well as in designing and development of a health promotion disease prevention national program. Ahmed's public health activities also involved collaborating and working with the World Health Organization, as well as other international public health organizations in New York. He has co-authored several publications related to infectious diseases, CNS and pain, as well as health policy. Ahmed is also a senior researcher at one of the pharmaceutical companies working on health outcomes research. With that, I give you Ahmed.
So it's obvious from my bio that I'm the one to speak about these issues with all the scientific and public health background. But anyway, I want to thank Muslimish, Abdullah, Issam, Zarar, and everybody for not giving up on inviting me every year on your conference, even though I have a little bit of a different opinion. I'm going to blow some of your assumptions that people consider your opinions as something that always high up. So you know that I disagree with you all the time. So that's something that I think is healthy within Muslimish, and I'm glad that it's available here. I won't be doing scientific slides like you are, so even though it's, you know, I would lean towards such types of presentations, but I won't do that. Luckily, you know, I didn't have much time to develop slides, so I will not bore you with many slides on that front. Actually, Zarar was nagging on the slides until yesterday, and I'm not sure what that is. But he was not rigid enough to stand on having the slides, and he was flexible, and he focused on what's the objective, which is communication, and he didn't fall hostage about having slides as something as sacred, which is, I think, sacred is a very important word that I think is relevant to the topics that we're discussing here. On the other side, for example, in many places that I work in, whether in academia or even the private sector, slides are very sacred now. People have to have slides. And it's a very important means of communication. If you don't have slides, then you should not be able to communicate. And, you know, they're holding it very sacred and they're very rigid. And if you don't do those slides, then you don't belong. You have to, you know, belong to the group. And it's a very righteous mentality that slides is the way to go forward. I'm going to take you a little bit into historical snapshots of my experience with criticizing ideas within Islam. And I like that term, Iman, that you mentioned. Debating and criticizing ideas within Islam and having that critique mind and questioning so that we would avoid that problem that our friend here was mentioning, that when he had that debate about the situation of women in Islam, he had that pushback. And probably the pushback is because of that feeling of sacredness and belonging, and you don't touch something that is very sacred to us. And that, of course, has to do with not being able to critique and question So that's a very important element. So going back historically into some of the snapshots, so I was in medical school, and those who are in the Middle East know that usually medical schools have the most conservative and fundamental religious groups. Engineering and medical school, these are where they house the Muslim Brotherhood and the others and so on. So we get exposed for 7 full years to those I would consider friends, because I disagree with you that they are not terrorists. Maybe there is a definition of the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization or not, but those belonging there, I cannot frame them as terrorists, all of them. So I know and still know many of them, and I don't count them as all terrorists. There are some of them who think in a very extremist way, but there are many of them that actually do not fall into that bucket. But anyway, exposure to them during medical school, that was also my first exposure about that issue of sacred ideas, how you pray, your position when you're praying, how your foot should be positioned when you finish your prayers, which hand is in front of which hand, is your hand on your side or on your up there, how do you wash your elbow before your hand. And for me, I mean, it was really strange that given that we're in such science schools where rationale is the main way of thinking, that actually, so those are supposed to be the scientists of the future. That's actually how they approached many of the sacred ideas within Islam. And that gave me lots of questioning there, of course. So they also behaved in that authoritarian manner. They felt that they held a higher moral ground. They told me what's right and what's wrong. They refused to accept, different views. Maybe they were tolerant for the first 5 or 10 minutes, and then that that became a little bit irritated for them. And that, I must admit, it took me time to start questioning that, because also I felt the belonging. I felt the belonging within that group of very nice people. They are very righteous. They feel righteous. So that sense of belonging, kept me tied to them. And it took me quite a bit of time to start, disentangling that attachment. Now, moving forward many, many years after, in 2011, we had in our region the Arab Spring, the revolution, the Arab Spring, and what we hold so dearly, at least many of us, and definitely the younger generations, the younger ones, they definitely hold highly and respect the 2011 revolution. But that also put people into some questions. So the question in many instances that I had, for example, given that I supported the revolution, those who held back to supporting Mubarak in the case of Egypt, the question that came back to me, do you love the army? Are you questioning that the army would do anything wrong? Are you against having our national order and nationalism and being Egyptian? Are you against that? When Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president, was speaking about the Ummah rather than Egypt, so that was a big thing. How can he speak anything besides Egypt and the country? So they held certain concepts very, very sacred, and they refused that you would even question anything about the army and about what they're doing, even though there were data that said that actually what they called virginity tests were done by the army. And other horrible things in terms of killings and otherwise. However, still, people held them in a very, very sacred position, and they did not allow for any sort of questioning. Yes. and to even to cheat you, I'm making into animated into different... So, yes. So anyway, so what I'm going to is that holding certain principles and holding certain institutions and holding certain ideas sometimes become sacred to different people, not necessarily just with the religious people. And they all share the same characters that we see: authoritative, holding a higher moral ground, intolerant to other views, can't see any virtues to the others, and everything is for them is untouchable, at least what they believe in, whether it's the army, whether it's the Quran, whether it's religion, whether it's the ideas and so on. It's that holding something very sacred to their minds and heart. Now, also moving few years after what we call the revolution got defeated by and the old guard took over, people who believed much into the in the revolution started having the revolution as a sacred actually thing, including ourselves. I refuse anybody to criticize the revolution. I refused anybody to criticize our positions in 2011, and I did not want to review if did we do something wrong or not wrong in 2011 that led to the defeat of the revolution and the old guard coming back. So again, that aspect of holding things in a sacred way. And I'm borrowing here a term by Jonathan Haidt that he would say, morality binds and blinds. So when you hold to that aspect of sacredness and morality, it blinds you in many instances. And that feeling of belonging into a higher moral group gets you into that fixation of that you start pushing back and fighting the same way like the colleague was asking about the women's situation and they pushed back against them. And that start of worshipping and circling about something that is sacred and holding it very, very, very dear. And maybe even slipping to that mentality of rigidness where, if you disagree with me, you're heretic, you're not Egyptian, you're not nationalist, you're blasphemous, there is no dialogue, and even to the extent of punishing, which is actually happening, at this stage. Not just against those who are against religion, it's happening those even who are, with liberal views and, against religion, they are even also being persecuted and imprisoned and killed in many of countries in the Middle East. So what I'm trying to arrive at is that we had those examples of early on that Abdullah, you made Islam al-Bahiri and Nasr Hamad Abu Zayd. Yes, of course they persecuted. But would we say they and of course they were persecuted because of their opinions against Islam and many of the Islamic ideas. But what about Adnan Khashoggi in the Turkish consulate? Was he also killed and persecuted because of Islamic opinions? Or was he killed and persecuted because of those fundamentalist mentality of holding things sacred? Whether it's religion, or whether it's a country, or whether it's a flag, or anything. Human beings tend to have the capacity to make things sacred, whether it's a rock, a tree, a flag, a country, a book, or otherwise. The other aspect is, I think there is a mix here. So I'm not at all saying that ideas should not be debated. On the contrary, we should debate ideas and we should, question and ask and challenge. What I'm against is bashing religion and bashing those who hold to the religion, because I don't think that a world without religion is a better world. I don't think if we erase tomorrow religion that the world peace is going to be spread all over the world and there won't be some other entity or institution that is sacred that people will be killing each other for. I think it's the issue of that fundamentalist mentality, whether that fundamentalist mentality is towards a flag, a country, an institution, a book, a religion, or whatever. That's where the battle is. The battle is not against religion, but the battle is about harnessing a critical mind and having people think and question. I think that's the problem that we're having all over the world, but specifically in the Middle East, of course. We raise generations and generations of people who do not question. And that gets exemplified, whether standing in a very extremist way, holding on to religion, or a very extremist way now, holding on to nationalism. And I get very worried stepping into the Cairo's airport in case some of my very close friends who hold nationalism to their heart have reported me somewhere because I'm a traitor. And I've had lots of those messages sent to me that I am a traitor. Again, because of that fundamentalist mentality. So I won't go much, again, I think it's that also aspect that we need to question. Are we also making scientific reasoning another sacred, untouchable way of addressing things? So, you know, we should be aware that we don't also, us, where we started by trying to break off of that fundamental mentality of people around us, we don't end up slipping into being fundamental ourselves and be fundamentalist ourselves, and also holding a higher moral ground above others and saying, actually, we think what's right. We know the passage to freedom of speech and other ways of solving human problems, because actually there is lots of common ground with people who hold religion as a title to them that could serve the purpose of what we're supposed to be defining. What is our battle? What exactly is our battle? Is our battle erasing religion? Or is our battle those ideas that Iman was mentioning that we need to correct, we need to have people question and ask? So so that's where I'm going to be ending with that question, that the answer is that fundamentalism is where the battle ought to be, and not necessarily religion, and help people be capable of reasoning and bridging that gap and finding where is it that we can have commonality with the other, and having one common platform and agree of where are we heading and head towards that. So I'll stop there and take any questions.
Catch up on time? Yeah, we're still a little behind, but I think we can just take one question and then we have a panel discussion where we can discuss the question.
Everybody's so convinced.
What about their low commonality? I think accepting the other even with no commonality is in the goal.
Yes. So even those who do not share with us the common view, you're saying that we should accept them?
Absolutely. Otherwise, yeah. We'll be making that same mistake like your friends who are, you know, maybe reporting you or others. So, we should.
I agree. So, I agree.
So it's not about finding commonalities, it's about accepting, opening
yeah. Yourself. No, what I meant by finding commonalities is finding commonalities towards what we're trying to achieve. Yeah. An object. So it's we start as of no refusal, unless somebody is violent or, you know, totally, doing things that do not fall into the values that we believe in. But if we, again, what Muslimish announced earlier on, that they are working towards freedom of speech, creating a space for questioning and so on, I think that's where we can find some commonalities and work towards that. Absolutely. And creating that space.
There's fundamental points that, rights, that are not questionable. But beyond that, that's
right. And maybe I will say another just comment, related to a question earlier. I think you asked why Saudi Arabia. The interesting thing is that the younger generations are starting to break. This is the positive news. Break sacred things. Smashing it, actually. And for those of you who are following, actually, the Egyptian politics, we celebrated 2 days ago with the day of national independence, the 23rd of July. And Nasser is a big, big, character in the history. Younger Egyptians have been bashing him left and right, that he's the defeated person. And my mother is completely appalled. How can, you know, they, you know, even speak about nothing this way? The younger generations are breaking those taboos and breaking those sacredness. And I think definitely Muslimish has a role, but I think there is some momentum already moving in the Middle East with that, those younger generations. Maybe it's the revolution of communication or otherwise.
Thank you for the talk. Just a reflection or a question on this theme that fundamentalism is where the battle ought to be fought, not religion. But religion is, in many cases, have been formulated or influenced by people who sometimes happen to be fundamentalists. So it is really sometimes it is two faces for the same coin. What if religion is fundamentalism? What if the source of fundamentalism is coming from a specific religion or an ideology that has been formalized, ritualized as a religion?
Mm-hmm.
Then fighting fundamentalism in that case has to be addressing the ideology behind it, which happens to be a religion. Yeah. I just worry about using religion as a protective shield for fundamentalist ideologies.
Possible, and I cannot assume that. Of course, I'm not an expert in religions and other religions, but at least with the little experience that I have in Islam, I think there is the positive sides and, of course, definitely the negative sides. And I find that there are many aspects in the religion that could be, you know, a platform for using it on the positive side. And of course, I see the many negative things that Iman mentioned, Abdullah mentions all the time. But I think you're always accused, Abdullah. But I think there, you know, I don't think just taking religion off the map will resolve, will achieve what we are aspiring for and what we speak of and hold high and dear to ourselves.
So speaking of being rigid, we should move to our panel discussion.
This is an extremist fundamental.
Yeah. So we'll start in 2 minutes.
Is this fine for you?
Yeah, we can bring the
table. Put the mic on.
Yeah.
Unless
it's too high.
This one is not working. No, I just dropped it.
Is that fine? Because I was saying we can get another chair too. If it's
as
lower.
Well, yeah, but
we have to put it lower.
This is fine. I don't mind. Yeah.
It will come out.
If it doesn't even annoy you.
Yeah. Oh yeah, did you get it at the front? I think I might have an extra one
I don't like that. That's very
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.